The Fallen Podcast will contain adult language and heavy spoilers. It is intended for a mature audience. Everyone, and welcome back to another Satan thrilling edition of the Cinema Recall Podcast, continuing our long series talking about David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. Coming back with me for this episode is one of my favorite navigators, Ryan Luis Rodriguez from The Reels of Justice as well as The Twinest Chronicles. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thank you for having me yet again, Vern. How you doing, buddy?
Doing good. I should mention, too, that Jason Soto from Whatever with Jason Soto can't make it on this episode, and he is a bastard, and I hate him forever. No, just kidding. I love you, Jason. You're my best friend, my buddy. And Jason, we'll be back on for our final episode, so I miss you, and can't wait for your return. Now, before we get into Mulholland Drive there, Ryan, you have some pretty big news to mention for the Reels of Justice podcast. Do you want to tell our listeners about it?
Absolutely. So we are celebrating our one-year anniversary. We've been officially doing this for 52 weeks straight, which is exciting. And we've had two of my absolute heroes, Trace Beaulieu and Frank Conniff from Mystery Science Theater 3000, from now they riff live as the Mads. We had them back after having them, I think, in maybe our 10th or 11th episode last year. And it was an episode that was so big, we had to split it into two episodes. So if you want to hear all about their year of streaming online and kind of doing the riffing thing, and then hear us kind of sum up the year that we've had, it's quite the adventure.
Very cool. Now, Trace Beaulieu, he played Dr. Forrester, right?
Yes, on the show? Dr. Forrester and the original Crow.
And the original Crow, that's right. And Frank Conniff, he was TV Franks.
Yes, TV's yes. Frank, and he for the 5 years that he was on the show, he was the movie selector. Oh. So if you liked any of the movies, it's Frank's fault.
Okay. No, I did see the Mads when they were here in Minnesota because they had the whole anniversary of MST3K. They had the whole live thing happening in the Twin Cities, and I got passes to see that, and that was really exciting to watch.
You saw
them.
The MST3K reunion?
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Oh, yeah. And I even got to meet, like, I met Joel when he was, like, coming out. Because we had, like, press passes to go see the whole press thing that happened. And Joel was just coming out, and I just said a quick word to him. I was like, hey, I love your show. And he just, like, was leaving, and I didn't want to bother him. Because he was looking like he was, like, really going somewhere important. And I was like, nah, not to bother him. But, yeah, I saw the whole live show. It was a lot of fun. Took one of my coworkers to it. Yeah, it was a fucking blast. Yeah.
They have the two of them have some of the best chemistry, I think, in comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Easily. They're so funny together. And so, yeah. Funny apart, but even funnier together.
Mm-hmm. So I definitely saw the thing with the Mads. And there was a session with, Mike and Trace. And, oh, gosh, I'm a bad MST3K guy. I forgot the other guy's name.
Oh, Kevin.
Kevin, yes. Kevin Murphy, that's right.
Yes, the great Kevin Murphy, the golden voice of Kevin Murphy.
Well, that is exciting. So I urge everyone to go check out the Reels of Justice podcast. I'm going to put links in our show description so you check out that episode, their one-year anniversary, celebrating with Frank Conniff and Trace how do you say the last
name?
Beaulieu, okay. God, I'll never have them on my show now because I totally fucked up the last name, so...
He knows he has a complicated last name. It's okay. Fine. Right. He'll forgive you.
Okay, good. Well, very cool. Well, let's do this right now. Also, I do want to mention to Bitch Shadow right now that we have a new Patreon subscriber. So I want to thank Mr. Chris Revel of Let's Chat Podcast fame. He's become our latest Patreon member. So thank you to Chris. And also thank you to our other Patreon members, including Donnie Roberts, formerly of Cage's Kiss, now of Videorama Pod. Want to thank Matt and Ashley from Mashley at the Movies. I want to thank Jeanette Miller Mickenham from AKA Jeanette. And of course, I do want to thank Jason Soto from Whatever with Jason Soto. So I just want to give that little shout out right there. We're going to take a small break right now to play some ads from some amazing podcast shows. And then we'll be back to discuss more about Mulholland Drive.
Life on a spaceship can be boring. That's what I hear, though life aboard the Oz-9 is mostly about careening from one near disaster to the next. To fend off boredom, Gated Galaxies outfitted their ships with a number of challenges, like bombs, poisoned crew meals, and assassins. One nice thing they did, and we can only assume it was accidental, was to include the old-time Earth podcast, Grand Rapidians Play Video Games. Hosted by video game world record holders Willy, Ginger, and usually Simon, they review beers, describe video games, recommend other podcasts, and generally crack wise and have a grand old time. Not that we can enjoy any of the things they recommend, but whatever. Grand Rapidians Play Video Games, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the Nostalgia Junk Podcast, where one person's junk is another person's childhood. I'm Matt McGraw.
And I'm Kyle Smith. Join us each week as we take a deep dive into your pop culture consciousness and discuss everything from movies, TV, music,
cartoons, toys, video games, and more.
And we want to hear from you, so connect with us. Nostalgia means so many different things to so many different people, so share with us your favorite piece of nostalgia.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Nostaljunk Pod, and you can subscribe to us on all the major podcast platforms. Let's get this thing up to 88 miles per hour, and we'll see you next week.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
What's wrong?
I don't know who I am.
I wonder where you were going. Come on, it'll be just like in the movies. We'll pretend to be someone else. Silencio.
This is all an illusion.
You want to know who you are, don't you?
Where's this going?
Very strange day.
I'm getting stranger.
Welcome back, everyone, to our Map of Mulholland Drive series happening at the Cinema Recall Podcast. Joining me again, Ryan Luis Rodriguez from the Reels of Justice Podcast, as well as Quiz Chronicles. Yes, I'm going to say both those names again because they are both amazing shows, and I don't want you to ever forget that. Now, Ryan,
yes,
we are coming now to, I guess, we left off at the sequence where, you know, Adam's talking to the cowboy, and the cowboy gives him the ultimatum. You know, you're going to go to an audition, but when we show you this picture, you got to say, this is the girl. So he's in the turmoil right there. Now we cut to a scene where we have both Rita and Betty. They're in the kitchen, and it's you see the shot of Betty. And she says, what are you doing here? And Rita's like, what do you mean what I'm doing here? And at first, when I first watched this movie, I thought they were both kind of like arguing with each other. But then the camera pulls back to reveal that Rita's reading a script and they're acting out a scene. This is the big scene of Betty's audition.
Yeah. And she immediately breaks into a smile, which is what immediately diffuses the tension.
Yeah. I do love Rita's bad acting.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing to like, you know, act a character. It's another thing to be a character that's a bad actor. I mean,
yeah. It's a hard thing to do without actually coming off as an actual bad actor.
Yeah. You know, like, I'm reminded of that sequence in Boogie Nights where Julianne Moore has to say bad dialogue during her, you know, her porn scene with Mark Wahlberg.
This is a huge cock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like a difficult thing to actually do, to maintain that. So they're both doing the scene from what used to be like a soap opera. Basically, Rita says, you know, they'll put you away forever. And basically, says, go away before I kill you. And she goes...
Then I cry. And then I say with big emotion, I hate Drew! I hate us both!
The thing is a dumb script. But Rita says, well, you're a really good actress. And I love the fact, too, that Betty has somewhat of a Sunset Boulevard reference when she takes her cigarette and goes, thank you, darling. Kind of do the whole Norma Desmond
thing. The cool thing about the scene, though, is that this scene seems to be a requirement in all movies about actors, where they start off the scene with you thinking that it's actual dialogue and then revealing that it's just a script.
Yeah.
Because, like, even the year before this, like, Charlie's Angels, which is not entirely about actors but has a character who's playing an actor, has this exact same scene with Lucy Liu.
That's right, Lucy Liu and Matthew Blanc.
Yes.
And it sounds like they're both going to be talking about sex.
Or that they could be, or that he's a spy and that he knows that she's a spy, but really it's just they're rehearsing a scene.
There's rehearsing a scene. Okay.
Yeah, it's adorable. I love it whenever it shows up. It's always adorable.
No, it's a great moment too. But when I watch that moment in Charlie's Angels, I'm thinking, oh, they're saying double entendres because they want to fuck. I mean, they're actors. Maybe they're spies, but they're spies who want to fuck, and then you found out later that they're actors who are playing
they're
spies.
They're spy
don't
actors.
Fuck.
They're spectres.
Spectres. So, anyways, later on, Coco, the building manager, sees Rita on the couch, and she calls Betty over to talk to her, and she's saying stuff about Ruth wants to know who's staying in her apartment. And Betty's like, well, we got things all confused. Actually, this is a friend of mine. It's not Ruth's friend. This is my friend, Rita. She's really, really nice. And Coco reminds her of Louise that came to the apartment last night. And Coco says, you know, Louise has been known to say things that are not so much true. But if there is any trouble in this apartment, because Louise says to her last night that there is trouble, that someone's in danger. And Coco says to Betty, look, if there's a danger in this apartment, get rid of it. And there's no reason. I think Coco knows more than Betty because Betty's really kind of naive in the beginning part of the story right there.
She's the Pollyanna figure in the film.
Even, you know, when she first gets to L.A., everything's all bright and sunshiny. She doesn't even question when there's, like, a strange woman in her aunt's bathroom.
She's just like this happens to everybody, right?
Yeah.
Like, come on. That's what you accept when you come here.
Mm-hmm. Now we're actually going to get into kind of the main crux of this, and that is the audition scene. So Betty actually goes to the studio, which I believe is supposed to be the Paramount Studios, another sort of like Sunset Boulevard reference, but they don't actually show the Paramount gates. They can't show the Paramount logos.
Right. But I do think you're right. I do believe that that is what it's set up to be, because it's not Universal.
Yeah.
It has an actual back lot that isn't like a theme park. It seems like it could be either the Sony Culver lot or Paramount.
Yeah. I'm not familiar. I am sort of familiar with that shot of the car going into the Paramount gates because, again, it reminds me of Sunset Boulevard when Gloria Swanson's character drives in kind of like with that same car. Which references back to, hey, movies and the whole magic of movies and dreams and all that stuff.
Right.
So she gets to this, you know, basic audition room, and she's told to do a scene with this older actor. So I'm trying to place everything there. So she's watching this room, and she sees, you know, three girls sitting on one side of the couch. You have this director who's not really there. Not really paying attention to what's going on. Then you have the actor doing the scene, and then you have one of the producers, Wally, there.
And the actor looks positively orange.
Yes.
He's so radioactive in terms of his color.
Yeah. That's actor Chad Everett.
Yeah, from Medical Center.
I don't know Medical Center. I just looked him up, and I know he's been on episodes of Maverick And
he's been on episodes. If it was on TV in the 60s, Chad Everett has been on it.
He's also on this movie Airplane 2, the sequel.
He is. I actually, since that's going to be the next season of my podcast, I just actually wrote that episode and was amazed looking at him in that movie with his groovy 1982 mustache and him here with his Donald Trump coloring. it's a weird shift, and it was only like 18 years, but it looks like two completely different people.
Really? Is this there darker in the airplane?
Yeah, it's dark brown. Everything is dark. He's much more, he's not, I wouldn't say pale, but more human flesh tone than he is in this movie.
Okay.
But looks almost unrecognizable.
Really? Okay. Fair enough there. I will have to check that out eventually. I don't think I saw Airplane 2 all the way. I know I saw parts of it.
Let's see. If you've seen Airplane 1, yep. I can guarantee you, you've seen Airplane 2, because it's the same movie, okay. Just with a spaceship.
Oh, a spaceship. Okay, fair enough. All right. So they are, you know, going to do the scene together, and I do love the fact that all the women in the there, because there's like a casting agent there with her assistant, another like famous casting agent, and they're all watching this one scene. This seems like a lot of people for an audition.
Because you know how old casting agents always stop by and they have to see the new guard train on deck? You know, okay. Like that always happens.
Yeah,
of course.
See, sure. You know, I just thought they just want to shout out, you know, hey, this new hot lady, this new blonde. In fact, too, that the rehearsal, so basically the scene that they're rehearsing is for like a soap opera, and it involves a much older man having an affair with a much younger woman, and right. They're afraid of them being caught by the girl's parents, who seem to be very successful. Like, both, I believe, the dad and his best friend are both very highly successful, rich mogul people, and they don't want their parents to find out about it. So I assuming that in this role, this girl has to be at least 16, 17 years old. I'm 17, 18. I'm going to go legal right there, but... I'm sure the guy, he's in his 60s, but I'm sure they're trying to have him pass out to be like 40.
Probably.
You know?
I mean, that's the whole point of the industry, is you always got to play younger than you are. Unless you're a woman, in which case you have to basically play your age.
Now, we saw this scene played with Rita and Betty in the beginning part, and that one was all about like emotion. Basically, it's all kind of fast dialogue.
Yeah, Betty, pounding it out, getting the words out there.
In the sequence, in the actual audition with Naomi Watts' character and Chad Everett's character, there is this moment where you're not just watching actors read lines, but you're believing their characters. Like, this is actually happening. And it's the moment, actually, there's this great video I saw from this YouTuber called The Nerdwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how David Lynch manipulates on what you are thinking is going to happen with the scene. And it's the moment right when Naomi Watts takes the guy's hand and puts it on her thigh and her ass and kind of has it leave it there and just leans in and starts giving him like small little kisses while reciting the lines.
You know what I want? It's not that difficult.
Get out before I call my dad. He trusts you. You're his best friend.
It's a smoldering kind of slow burn version of what we already saw, but it's first of all, it's kind of sexy, like a little bit.
Yeah.
Like not in a way that's like, oh, that's so hot.
Yeah.
But in a way that's like, okay, this is something that you didn't expect from the material hearing it the first time.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a remarkable thing, to write a scene that is not changed word for word, but if you change the inflections and if you change the pacing, it becomes a completely different scene.
Oh, very, very much so, because when you heard the sequence or saw it with Betty and Rita, it's very comical. It's because of the, like you said before, the inflections and the pitch changes. Now everything has been slowed down, and you're right, Ryan, the scene is actually very quite erotic. And
yeah, it gets intense.
It gets like, very
actually intense.
Very much intense. And watching this, I tend to forget that these are actors, and I'm into the storyline of these characters, and I start to believe how this girl is feeling being involved with this relationship with this older man, and I start to feel her, her disappointment, her resentment of the whole thing. And she has, Naomi Watts has these tears in her eyes, and I'm thinking, well, I'm seeing the tears of these characters, not so much Betty or Naomi Watts. It like transcends. It goes from Naomi Watts playing this character Betty to this other woman, this fiction the woman who's having this relationship with this older man. That part becomes real.
Yeah, I always like to argue that when people say that she gives two different performances in the movie in terms of the two halves, I like to say that she actually gives three, because this scene is a completely, as you said, a completely different person with her own interior life.
Well, safe to say that after this, Betty just impresses everyone. The producers really thrilled. Not so much sure about the director, who kind of takes his directions from the producers. That part was kind of hilarious. The fact that Wally has to inform him on a Wednesday action, and kind of tells him everything what to say.
Yeah,
But
good stuff.
he basically, impresses everyone. The casting agents want to bring Betty to a set of a different movie. And I love the sequence when they're walking out, and one of them says, "God, that was awful." And then Betty just has that look of like just total shock and like disappointment. And they're like, no, not you, Betty. You were stellar, and I mean that." But and they talk about, poor Wally. He's never gonna get this play out, or never get the script off the ground. He's kind of like been had been done. Well, we got this new production that's ahead above everything else, and we think you'll be perfect for it. And they bring her to this big sound stage, where you are seeing. Well, first of all, you see this woman singing this song. It's called 16 Reasons by Kanye Stevens.
16 reasons why
dressed up like a late 1950s, early 1960s chanteuse.
Yes, and she has background singers, and they're doing the whole song. The song gets over with. She says to Adam, "I'm gonna be the perfect person for this role." And Adam's like, "I know, but I gotta see everyone else." And then afterwards, he gets news that the next person up for audition is Carmela Rhodes, the person that he's making photos about. The ones that all the executives say, this is the girl. Well, she's finally there. She's gonna do her audition, and she picks the song "I've Told Every Little Star" by Linda Scott, which is actually our theme music that we've been playing for all these episodes of our series. Now, I mentioned in a previous episode that Carmela Rhodes is played by Melissa George.
Yes, from Alias. Oh, I love Melissa George.
Yeah, I didn't realize too. She her credits include like Dark City.
Yep. Oh, yeah. And she's in the Amityville Horror remake.
Yep, with Ryan Reynolds. She's this great little Australian horror flick called Triangle,
Yes, good movie.
which I saw there. She's also in the new Mosquito Coast series, and she also played the role of Lynn Brackett, the Kim Basinger character in the L.A. Confidential pilot.
Oh, that's right. The one with Kiefer Sutherland, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she was in that. So she's like this, the main girl that everyone's talked about. She sings her song. The executives come over to Adam, and Adam just looks at the him with complete fear and also disgust as well, and says, "This is the girl." But also in the corner of his eyes, he sees Betty.
Yes.
And he looks at Betty, they both lock eyes, and it seems that it's love at first sight. It's that whole wonderful thing that happens in film where two characters meet each other and they are absolutely infatuated. He's like, holy shit, this is the girl I want for sure. This is the girl. Why am I casting this other girl?
Okay, I interrupt this program to inform you that it actually was the first song that Adam notices Betty, not the second song. So that was my bad, bad host, and now back to the show.
But yeah, and it's funny too, Ryan, I watched a video about Melissa George being cast in this movie, because David Lynch has a very weird casting process when it comes to movies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what that is?
No, I don't.
Well,
tell me.
He puts a bunch of photographs on a table, like everyone's headshots, and he just kind of looks around at photos. He doesn't look for anyone's audition tapes. He just has a big table of photos, and then he looks around, he does a meditation, and then basically he chooses actors based on that.
Ah, that's certainly something that David Lynch would do.
When it came to, you know, casting Naomi Watts, you know, he saw her headshot, but then when she came in to audition, she didn't look at her headshot, and so it was kind of disappointing for him. So she had to come back and go over it again, but then it worked out that fine. But I find it to be kind of fascinating. Not, yeah, I just thought it was strange because it works in all of his films. It works well for the
cast. It's kind of amazing that his casts are as eclectic as they are, considering that that's how he does it. Because you would think that seems like, especially with how everybody else does it, that would occasionally lead itself to like blowing up in his face at least once. But
yeah.
It is hard to watch a David Lynch movie or even like the Twin Peaks series and find an actor who doesn't really seem suited to what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean,
so clearly it pays off.
Yeah. And I know that I'm going to say her name wrong here, but Joanna something here is his main casting.
Oh,
agent.
Shit.
Joanna Rae.
Joanna Rae. There you go.
Joanna Rae has been doing all this casting for his films for years. So I'm pretty sure she does help a lot in making sure.
Yeah.
The right
and I'm
actors.
Sure that by now she knows his temperament. So she knows what he's looking for and she can kind of give him the right headshots in that way.
Very much so. And then, okay. So basically after the, Bitsing happens, and we do find out too that the movie that Adam is shooting for is the Sylvia North story.
Yes,
that's what he's shooting for. But Betty remembers that she has to help out her friend Rita, so she leaves the audition, runs out, and both her and Rita, they go to this friend's apartment. They actually go to Diane Selwyn's apartment.
Yes. Looking for the woman whose voice they heard on the phone.
Yes. So they go there, they meet another woman, and they learn that both her and the woman's apartments, they have been switched. So
yes.
They go to that same apartment, and this is where they discover this dead woman in this room.
It's one of the most horrifying things in the movie, the image of the woman that's been there for days.
Yeah.
Oh, so, oh.
I know, right? Yeah, the mouth is wide open like that. Yeah, it's disgusting.
Face is decaying. Oh, God, it's, oh.
And this freaks them out. And I love the moment when they come out of, I don't know what you, I guess it is an apartment, but it's sort of like a cottage. But.
Yeah, it's almost a bodega.
Bodega,
almost.
Yes.
A bungalow.
Bungalow. There you go. They come out of the bungalow, and I love the fact that the frame sort of distorts their faces.
Yeah.
Like, you see, like, echoes of themselves, like, breaking apart. It looks like they're breaking apart. And I thought it was a cool kind of, like, camera technique. But no,
yeah.
When you rewatch again, it's just, things are unraveling. Things are starting to unravel. And
yes.
That's kind of like our first little other clue of things not seeing like they should be. All right?
Because we're starting to learn actual concrete information about things. And
yeah.
As we do, it starts to challenge the preconceptions that we had about these characters when we started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you know, you go to see, you want to find out about a clue about something, you get this name, you go into someone's apartment, you're thinking, I'm going to find maybe someone's driver's license, or,
right.
I'm going to find maybe an old coffee cup, maybe, you know, an old CD or a movie that left at someone's place, that would be a good clue. I don't want to find a dead body.
Yeah.
That's not a fun mystery. I don't
want
to
find
that.
Like a bag of cocaine. Like something that's like scandalous, but a dead body, that's too scandalous.
That's too scandalous. Yes, I agree with that. I don't really much like coke, but I like to find more coke than a dead body. I agree with that.
I don't like cocaine either, except when I'm snorting it. But no, kidding. I don't do drugs, folks.
That's fair. I'm all about heroin, man. That's fine.
I'm all about crystal. You know,
crystal, yeah. See,
some bennies. I'm all about them. Oh man, it's good stuff.
So. I'll let that part out there. So they go home, and Rita wants to, like, you know, cut her hair, change it, and Bay's like, no, you don't have to do that. She gives her this blonde wig, yes. And they're both looking at each other in the mirror, and, you know, they're both admiring how well they looked at each other. They go to bed, and Betty says, you know, you don't have to sleep on that couch. There's plenty of room in this bed. And right away, I'm thinking, yes, there is plenty of room in that bed. That's
that's a very big bed. Thank you for noticing.
What a good neighbor you are. That's very good. And then Rita, being very neighborly, you know, takes off her robe and walks in naked. I'm like, yes, you are being a really good neighbor as well. Coming to the naked.
You're a real humanist. Now get in that bed.
Yeah, see, that's
nice. Love your fellow woman. I mean, man. I mean, whatever. Just get in that bed.
Yeah, see? And, you know, Rita starts to undress Betty, as good humanists do.
Yes.
And
Yes, we do.
Yes, they start to have sex. Betty confesses her love to Rita. I like the scene, too, like, where Betty says, have you done this before? And Rita goes, I don't know. Because she has amnesia, and that's just
fine. That's a good David Lynch joke.
Yes.
That's very much in his wheelhouse. It's so cute.
And then afterwards, in the middle of the night, Rita starts speaking Spanish. She's saying, oh, no hay banda, and she's telling Betty, go with me somewhere. And Betty's like, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Remember to go with you places here. She's like, please, go with me somewhere, right now.
And now, before we get to that, can I ask you a question?
Okay.
In the scene where Laura Elena Herring becomes naked, do you think that that scene was in the TV show version of the pilot, but without the nude scene, which was probably shot later? Or do you think that the entire scene was not in the pilot?
Because I watched the TV pilot. The TV pilot, it's actually on YouTube.
Oh, cool. I gotta look that up now.
They do. And what happens is, okay, the last scene you see them at is when they come out of the bungalow.
Okay. That's what I figured.
That when they start with the dead body, actually the episode ends where they see the dead body and they come out, things get distorted, and then the last sequence you see is you see the bum in the alleyway.
Okay. All right.
And that's how the pilot episode ends, basically to be like a cliffhanger for episode 2. So
awesome.
You realize there's like a dead body, there's this guy in this alleyway, what's going on? Find out in episode 2. Well, the new sequence happens now with them going into the room, which is always a good way to the actors come back to a set. I'm sure David's like, hey, look, the pilot is no longer a go, but we're going to make it into a feature. So come back. This day, we'll have you on set, both, you know, bring Naomi Watts, Laura Aaron, come back to the studios, we're going to shoot new sequences, and I'm sure the actors get all excited to get there, and like, well, we're shooting David, and David's like, we're shooting a set scene.
So Laura, you're going to be naked. Okay.
Yeah. Naomi, you're going to be naked too, you guys are going to kiss each other. It's going to be mysterious. People are going to be like, what the hell is going on here? I don't know, but I like it.
I'm making it for Europe. Their European money made the movie. They want to see the ladies kiss.
Yes.
All right, David. Well, I mean, you're a director, so you would know.
Yep. Okay. So, both Rita and Betty decide to go to this place. This place called Club Silencio.
Yes.
And what we discover about this club. Now, one thing too, like, I want you to, like, when you do watch them in the car, even when they're standing waiting for the cab, I love how the camera distorts things and puts things out of focus. Even when they're driving in the car to the club, the camera has things out of focus and sort of separates things.
It's called Shooting Dirty.
Yeah, because everything before was kind of done in traditional filmmaking status, but now with them going to the club, we're getting a lot of handhelds. Things are moving kind of wonkily. Frames are going in and out of focus. So they get to this nightclub, which is Club Silencio, and there's this announcer, and he's basically telling us that we hear a band, but there is no band.
No, I banda. There is no band. Il n'est pas de orchestra. This is all a tape recording. No, I banda, and yet we hear a band. If we want to hear a clarinet, listen.
We see a guy coming out with a trumpet. He plays it, and then he lets it go, but the trumpet still plays. The announcers mention this is all an illusion, a tape recorder. Yes. Now, the big thing that happens now is they bring out famous singer Rebecca Del Rio to cover Roy Orbison's Crying.
Que te quiero aún más, mucho más que ayer. Dime tú qué puedo hacer. No me quieres ya. Y siempre estaré.
Well, one cool thing too, Ryan, is the fact that now when Rebecca Del Rio sang this song, now the version you're hearing was just done in one take.
That, I mean, she has a 3-octave voice, so that would not surprise me.
You know, like she's
a hell of a musician.
She literally got out of the cab, went into the studios, Angela Benavente was there, she belted out the song in one take, David heard it, and it was like, all right, that's going in the movie. And
it was a song that she had sung before she got the role in the movie.
Yeah.
She became known for, because it's the song Crying is a Roy Orbison song, but she sang it in Spanish as Llorona, which is Spanish for crying. And that was kind of how she got her foothold into the industry. And then somebody played that track for David Lynch, and he liked it so much that he hired her to be in the movie and sing it.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Which is something, I mean, he loves musicians. We talked about that last time, that he keeps putting them in his movies, whether or not you think that there's an organic way to fit them in, but he finds an organic way. He finds a way to utilize them properly.
And I got to say that her singing the song really affects our two lead characters very well. They are just emotionally, you know, crying over the song. There's even a moment that happens before this song, too, where, like, this lightning happens and Bae starts shaking her seat, which I never quite understood. Maybe she's starting to feel the fear of her nightmare that she's enveloping there. Maybe she's knowing that what's going to happen next is not going to be good.
Or maybe Lynch doesn't even know why he did it, and he did it because he wants people to walk out of the movie and go, so what the hell was that about?
Yeah.
Get that, people talking, you know?
That's true. Like, I know I saw interviews too. David Lynch never likes to give any explanations.
Oh, he refuses. Flat out refuses, including to the actors who are playing those scenes.
Yeah.
If an actor asks him, David, why am I doing this, he won't tell them, which is, gotta admire sticking to your guns like that.
I know, right? Yeah. But he also likes to having people kind of figure out what it is.
Yeah, he wants to give the audience an active participation in the film. And by not knowing what any of these what any of his symbolism means, it allows us to give our own meaning that has some kind of personal connection for us.
Yeah. Did you have, like, a personal connection with this scene?
This scene, yeah, because it was the moment when I truly started taking in that this was a David Lynch movie.
Okay.
Like, before this, things are they're a little off, like we kind of also discussed last week. Like, it's the peyote has been ingested but hasn't kicked in yet. So we're starting to see colors.
Yes.
Throughout the movie. But this is where it just completely collapses and our hindbrain kicks in and we start running around in the desert and shouting to the gods. Like, this is a scene that is like, okay, this is the Lynch that I know.
Yeah.
This is the Lynch that I came here for. And the first hour and 20 or hour and 30 of the movie, I think, are great, but I'm really only glad for them because it gets us to this point. Like, all the TV pilot stuff, mm-hmm. I think, is fantastic. It would not have worked as a series, but I think it's great. But I love it when Lynch starts playing in the sandbox that I expect him to play in.
That's a good point. And yes, we are definitely getting to, like, Lynch territories here, especially with the scene.
It gets fucked up later.
At Club Silencio. And so afterwards, both Betty and Reed are hearing the song. Rebecca Del Rio is singing it. Halfway through the song, she falls to the ground, but the song keeps going. And
yes.
Two guys grab her, and they bring her out. Yeah.
And, behind the curtains that he loves so much.
And I think one of the guys that's there, isn't that the same manager from that hotel that Adam was staying at?
Cookie?
Yeah.
He might be.
I swear I recognize one of the actors from there. Okay, so roles are starting to kind of intrude on each other. We're seeing stuff that's happening in Adam's story interfering with this one. So both girls, they get home. I forgot to mention one thing, too. While they're at the club, Betty finds this blue box in her purse.
Yes, a literal mystery box.
Little mystery box. And they go home to their house. They both walk into the bedroom. Betty puts a purse on the bed, and the camera zooms in to, like, Betty grabbing, like, a hat box out of the closet. She turns around. Betty's gone. We just look around everywhere. Once in the bathroom, calling out her name. She's nowhere to be found. Rita goes into the hat box, finds the purse with all the money and the blue key, opens up the blue box. The camera zooms into the blue box. It drops on the ground. Now Rita's gone.
Yep. Goes in and out.
Nowhere to be found. Where did she go? And that's where we're going to end our discussion.
What could happen, Vern?
What could happen?
What's going on?
What's happening? We have both of our main characters just gone. They have just disappeared. What happened?
That can't be good.
That can't.
Uh-oh.
You'll have to stay tuned to our next episode to hear the final conclusion of what happens in this. And I'm super excited. I've just been having a freaking blast going through these scenes one at a time. Because now, after talking with you guys for a little bit there, I think I finally have this mystery solved. And I don't think
I'm any closer to the answer.
I feel like
I'm even further away. But that's good. That's where I want to be.
I have my theory. So, see, here's the thing too, Ryan. I've watched the movie, like, a lot of times. Like, my parents own this movie. And I know I watched it at least every year. And each time I watch it, I get new enjoyment out of it. I discover new little clues and hints. And if I don't discover anything about it, I just like watching these actors. I love watching these actors perform these scenes. I love the combination of music and set design. And yeah, I don't know why. I just love this movie. I show it to friends of mine and they're like, I don't get it. And I'm like, you're not supposed to get it. How do you feel watching it? And they're like, well, I feel confused, Fern. That's how I feel. I don't know. I mean, I don't know why you show me this stuff here. I want my movie to have a beginning, middle, of an end. I'm like, well, it does, but you're supposed to interpret your own views about it. And they're like, well, can't the director do that for me? I'm like, no, you just tell me what you're supposed to be thinking or feeling about this.
Yeah. I just want to show up and eat my popcorn and have the director tell me everything I need to feel.
Oh. All right. Well, I mean, there are those kind of people. There are those kind of movies. So maybe go watch one of those.
Yeah. Now I have a few friends that, you know, do like Lynch's work and like the surreal quality
cool
of it.
Ones.
You know, all my friends are cool. I can't blame them for the taste. That's fine. You know,
can't blame them for liking shitty movies. You're so nice to your friends.
David Lynch is a very much, he's not for everyone, and that's fine. No. And I love the fact that he's not for everyone. You know,
very much an acquired taste.
And I kind of appreciate the most about him, is the fact that he goes out there, takes chances, more so than, I think, any of the filmmaker. I don't know. Maybe the Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
The
director of
Darktooth and The Favourite.
Yeah, and, shit.
The Killing of a Sacred
Deer. The Lobster.
The Lobster.
So good. Oh, my God.
The Lobster's incredible. Have you seen The Killing of a Sacred Deer?
No, that's on my list. I have it in the collection, but I have not watched it yet, but I'm dying to see it.
My favorite movie of his is probably Alps.
That's one I haven't seen. I just watched Dogtooth a couple months ago, but I haven't gotten to Alps yet. I have the Kino Blu-ray.
Okay.
But I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, that's a very deranged way. And I need to watch The Killing of a Sacred Deer over again, because that was one that I just didn't like at first, but I know it's one that if I watch again, I'm gonna like it more. So I will double it for that. But anyways, folks, that is going to wrap up this episode right now of Cinema Recall Podcast. Thank you very much to my wonderful guest, Ryan Luis Rodriguez, of Coolest Chronicles, as well as Wheels of Justice. Thank you, buddy.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you very much, man. And we will see you all next week or so. Don't forget to check out all of our past episodes of our Map of Mulholland Drive series happening on our website, cinemarecall.net. We're available on Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Audible, every place you need podcasts. Find us there. We're on Twitter at @cinema_recall. Join our crack. Join us and be a crackhead at our Cinema Recalls Awesome Cinematic Club, which I'm labeling crack because I love all my crackheads. So join our Facebook group. And that is all. We will see you again very soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
What was the most important statement you wanted to make in this movie?
I wanted to make the movie. And what happens is, if we're lucky, we get ideas that we fall in love with. And then you have the great joy of translating those ideas into a medium, in this case, like into a film. And this is such a great journey, and it's so beautiful. That's the whole point of it, is to get lucky and catch ideas that you fall in love with, and then get to translate them into something, manifest them into something. And that's what it's all about for me.
Right, I almost said Mighty Python. Like, I don't know why. But
we
would
can
love...
do that too. That's fine. That's totally fine. I can talk about Mighty Python all day.
I want a Mighty Python Mulholland Drive.
I want a Muppet Mulholland Drive.
Oh,
I want
yes.
to see like Gonzo play Naomi Watts. And Fozzie play Laura Elena Herring.
No, I would have Janice play the Naomi Watts.
You know, that's a good point, and shame on me for not picking up on it earlier. But yes, I'd love to see Janice play that role.
Yeah. I don't know who would play Rita.
Miss Piggy would be insulting, so
no, yeah,
let's
see,
not go with Miss Piggy.
I don't want to go Miss Piggy. In fact, the Rita character is the only one that could be human, I guess, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess. Because, yeah, you need that underpinning element that's the human to kind of balance everything, unless you have the Muppet Show.
Oh, so
in which
true.
Case, all you need is Muppets. But,
that's true.
Yeah, for the movies, yeah, you need to have a human in there. So, I don't know. Maybe she should play the role again.
Oh, okay.
Reprise it, you know? Like, it's all in the same continuity or something.
Right, Dark Wig or something like that. Okay, hold on here one second. I'm just trying to go to where my notes are. Okay, all right.